the rest of the story. The city was a tinderbox, demonstrably so. Fires were always breaking out among the closely clustered, mostly wooden buildings. Flames were always licking out from one or another next door and then from one narrow street to the next, particularly during the torrid summer of 64. And yet, whenever we relate a conflagration to that date, we think of one. We think of just one, a blaze so devastating that it turned three heavily populated districts to ashes and seriously damaged all but four of the remaining neighborhoods in town. It started, investigators would conclude, in some shops containing highly combustible materials. There was a stiff breeze blowing the night of July 18, one strong enough to spread the fire ahead of all efforts to contain it. Innumerable trapped, perished homes, public buildings, places of worship were swept away beneath waves of black smoke. And yet, despite the many accidental town fires preceding it, a cry of arson rang out before the ashes of July's conflagration were cold. And where did the footprints in the cinders lead? To the doorstep of a religious cult. Actually, to a radical, fanatical faction of that cult, a small group that preached salvation through fire. And no place on earth needed salvation more, these fanatics believed, than this dirty, depraved, licentious, libertine town. The trial of the accused arsonists lasted 2 months. There were a number of acquittals. The rest were convicted of arson, essentially of murder. Meanwhile, a government project was underway to provide food and shelter for the multitude left homeless and to rebuild the incinerated city. And gradually, the townspeople began seeing this tragedy as a blessing in disguise, an opportunity for structural improvement and otherwise beautification. Where the streets had been inconveniently, even dangerously narrow, now they were widened. Where dismal, dilapidated slums had once stood, the land was cleared and safe. Secure housing was erected. And for the accomplishment of these noble deeds, for making the best possible of a bad situation, the city and the nation as well had one man to thank. And he's a man whom history may have misjudged. Today, as we peel back the layers of time, we see this man, an eccentric, to be sure, who nevertheless presided over a 14-year period of peace and prosperity and cultural dynamism unique in that era, a patron of the arts, a friend of the common man. But because this leader incurred the enmity of a couple of contemporary writers, and because scholars until recently have drawn their conclusions based on what those writers wrote, generation upon generation of schoolboys and schoolgirls have envisioned a passionately cruel, pathologically frivolous emperor who stood atop the tower one night playing the fiddle while Rome burned, perhaps after having started the fire himself. Well, the Emperor Nero, we now know, when the fire of 64 A.D. broke out, was in fact at his villa in Antium, some 30 miles away. All your life you've read that the ancient Romans threw Christians to the lions. The court records reflect it was the ancient Christians who threw Rome into the flames. But at least now you know who didn't do it. Because now you know the rest of the story.